This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we get three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in the classroom. Tell you more about them as the show goes on, or visit jamsoftware.com. We've also got Aerohive, the makers of great cloud-managed controllerless Wi-Fi, and Tap Typing, an app that teaches students to type on the iPad. With a structured curriculum and lessons ranging from beginning to advanced, typing tests for improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard, has support for all kinds of external keyboards and keyboard cases. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
It's a big week.
Yes, indeed. Next week's an even bigger one. I'm forgetting our show days. Next week will be a big week.
Yeah, I guess it's good that our show comes out on Monday so people can listen to this show, and then, you know, for the rest of the week it can be all iPhone announcements. Yeah, it's one of the, you know, I don't know if the listeners know that we record on Thursdays, and so it's almost good when they have these events on Tuesday, because we have a day or two to kind of digest it and you know, and try to look at it a little different way than just here's what they announced. But you've probably already read that on the 5,000 blogs anyways.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that's especially helpful if they make any new iOS 8 announcements. It's probably not likely, but the one thing we could see is some sort of iOS 8 feature that requires something in hardware. Maybe the new iPad Air feature, if that, you know, the rumored iPad Air 2 is announced, maybe it's some new cool hardware feature that we might really care about for the school.
Yeah, I strongly suspect we're not going to see iPads next week. I think it's just going to be iPhone, and possibly if the wearable thing is ready, it could be that too. But I think we'll get the usual thing where it's iPhones in September and iPads in October, and of course everything out for Christmas.
Well, they don't need to cram both the iPad and the iPhone into one event. They are big enough to stand on their own, and so you could come back in October, do Yosemite iPad, and maybe a redesigned 11-inch or 12-inch MacBook Air. It's sad the Mac never gets its own events anymore, but there's just not that much exciting in the hardware space on computers right now. One of the things I realized today as I was typing in my Apple ID on my Mac, that I really would love some sort of Touch ID for the Mac. And then one of the things they could do, I mean, obviously, like, you know, I've got a laptop that's still very functional, so can't really add it in, but they could easily add that to a redesigned external touchpad.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that could be a thing.
And then every Mac could, you could, you know, any Mac could have one at that point, especially certainly if you had a desktop. Then I don't know, you know, anybody that probably works at a desk probably doesn't want to use the laptop keyboard all day long.
No, probably not. But I think as the sooner we can get to everybody having a fingerprint scanner in their Mac, an iPhone and iPad, the better. Especially given the events of this week.
Well, that'll be really, that'll change, really change Mac deployments, I guess. And really, you know, I guess iPads in a way. I mean, that'll obviously be something that you have to work into the setup assistant that the end users will have to do on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that'll be interesting. I'm sure that'll be some MDM API where you can allow, disallow that. And that may already be there.
I believe there is a restriction for that already, disallow Touch ID.
Well, it'd be nice to enforce it.
Yeah, well, they strongly encourage you to set it up, but I suppose there are certain sensitivities around using biometric identifiers in school. I know there's been awkward situations with that in the past, so I'm not totally sure that I'm desperate for that in school. And I think I feel nervous right now with the existence of Activation Lock, you know, that every summer or every time a pupil leaves the school, I'm kind of like... Okay, we got past the Activation Lock this time. I successfully have not had to deal with it this year. Everything was all okay. But I think now that you can also get an Activation Lock bypass through MDM as well, so maybe I could use that if it came to the bit. But I don't know how many bypasses are going to build into these things.
Yeah, it's going to be... It'll be neat to see how this actually rolls out, because, you know, we've seen a lot of this stuff in Lenovo computers for years, but no one ever really did them. And this is the first time we've really seen, you know, again, like you said, biometric be something that actually is a thing that people want to use. It's, you know, I guess this comes down to Apple controlling the hardware and the software.
Yeah, it does. And I think what you might see is that the procedure for turning in a device at the end of the school year might become a much more kind of in-person thing. You know, at the moment, what I've done is I've kind of said, well, here's a basket, get your classes, put all their iPads in this basket, and I'll wipe them over the summer. But I think in future, it's going to have to be a lot more kind of, right, you personally come and hand your iPad to me, we will go through a checklist of four things that you have to do to make it so that I can erase this device easily and not have to activate it again. So that may be a little more time-consuming in future, but at the for the benefit of more security, I guess.
Yeah, there's that pendulum with security and usability, and I think, you know, if it takes a little bit longer on turn-in dates, you know, and really, you almost have that anyways with Find My iPhone, because you got to make sure that's turned off. If you're turn-in and they're not going to get the same one back the next year, yeah. Find My iPad has to be turned off.
Yeah,
we're selling our phones to Gazelle. My wife and I are, and that's like in big, big bold in the box. Be sure to turn off Find My iPhone before you send it, because it's really difficult to get around that.
Yeah, they're freaking out about that on all those recycle sites. There was a story in the British press a while ago about a dead woman who had bequeathed her iPad to her son and had not told him her Apple ID password before she died. And Apple would not bypass the activation lock for the son, even though he had her last will and testament, which said, to my beloved son, I leave my iPad. Apple were just like, nope, sorry. So they're serious about it.
Yeah, I mean,
not so much about iCloud rate limiting, though.
Yeah, that's one of those, like, if that had turned out bad, they wouldn't have fired Eddie Q, would they? No. Because who else is going to do it?
Yeah, well, he's got so many different roles that's one, but stuff like that, as much as we like the things that Apple does, that does make me a little nervous about things like iCloud keychain syncing and all my photos on Apple's cloud and so on and so on. So I think I might be keeping my alternative approaches to cloud storage as well, certainly for photos.
Yeah, I think I'm there. It's certainly, if I'm going to go in on iCloud photos, obviously I don't take nude selfies, so I'm not concerned about those leaking. And if I did, I don't think anybody wants them. But my concern is I would need to have a way to back those things up myself. Like I would need to know those things are in Time Machine and they're in Backblaze.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the actual implementation of these things is. I mean, there must be some amount of photos cached on your Mac somewhere, and whether those can be extracted into backup or something. I mean, I've been using Camera Sync on my iPhone, I think at your recommendation, Bradley, to upload, just whatever new photos I take to my Google Drive, and that's been very effective. And then I have a Hazel script that moves them into years and subfolders based on their file name and so on. So I think I'll probably keep doing that, even though I'm going to probably have iCloud Photos as my main primary way of looking at and accessing photos. I'd like to have a secondary method as well, just for belt and braces.
Well, one of the things that I struggle, like, I'm beta testing iOS 8 right now, and I'm typically one to empty out my camera roll. And so, like, I kind of have not been in the past few days, just kind of letting things hang around. Mm-hmm. And I can see, like, if you had years and years worth of photos, you've got a lot of scrolling to do to basically get to a certain spot. And, like, my folder-based method, we're moving, it's organized by months. I can easily go back and see my son's first birthday. Like, I know exactly what folder that's in because it makes sense. Mm-hmm. If it's just kind of like this one big stream that they're organized by date, that's got to be confusing.
Yeah, I mean, they did. I recently wrote an article that's just going to come out on Mac Stories quite soon about iOS 8 and education. And in as research for that article, I went back and I watched the keynote again. And one of the things that they emphasize is the ability to search your photos for certain things like locations and dates and so on. So it'll be interesting to see just how deep that goes and how useful it actually becomes.
Well, I guess, it's one of those. It's like I've always said with my system, is it scales up to 50 years. Does Apple's system, if you have 50 years worth of photos, which that seems crazy, but it's certainly conceivable you could have, say, 16, 17 years worth of digital photos now. Mm-hmm. Like, that's very conceivable. And so how does that scale up another 10 years? Because 10 years would go by very fast. Like, if you have all of those in iCloud photos, how useful is that? To go through. Yeah, we shall see.
True story. When my wife and I got married, one of the guests had a digital camera with him, And it was extremely kind of surprising because it was the first time most people at the wedding had seen a digital camera. That was the year 2000, I think. And it's amazing to see where we've gone from there. I mean, all our wedding photos are on film. Whereas now, you know, baby Georgia, born last year, she's never had a film photograph taken of her ever. And she probably never will have. And it's interesting just to see how quickly that's moved over. That's what, 15 years, 14 years.
Yeah, you know, I've got these books my grandparents gave me of just all of our, you know, photos growing up and thinking, this would be great digital, but I'm never going to take the time to do that. Like, I wish I could just, like, hand somebody these photos and they could digitize them. But the problem is I don't know the dates on them. That's the annoying thing. And that'd be the ideal, so I could organize those by dates. But,
yeah,
you know, oh, well.
You can do your best guess, but that's all.
It's like you're probably five there. Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Jamf Software. You guys know about Jamf. They've been with us for a while now. They provide your IT staff with enterprise tools to basically manage Apple devices in your organization, whether that's corporate or education. It covers Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs. They have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows them with their iPad to kind of manage their classroom environment so they can they can quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. So, again, we really appreciate Jamf sponsoring the show this week. If you want to learn more about them and what they can do for your school, go to outofschool.net, and this is show 101. Click the special link in there. It'll take you to Jamf's website and let them know that you heard about them from the show. And again, if you call them directly, we'd appreciate you mentioning that you heard about them from us. So, again, that's outofschool.net, episode 101. There's a special link for Jamf. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week. So the thing we wanted to talk about this week, I think, is near and dear to our or your heart this week because you've been doing training on it recently. Mm-hmm. It's our favorite cloud syncing service that's really cheap. It's Google Drive.
Yep. The whole stack, I think, is very interesting. This has been kind of hanging on my to-do list for a long time. I intended to do it before the summer and we couldn't find time to do it, but I've been putting together a training program for teachers on how to really get the most out of Google Drive, specifically Google Drive and Docs. And I think, you know, we'll have a chat about, you know, why Google Drive, what's strong about it, what's weak about it. And then I'll talk through just some of the kind of, I designed sort of four different sessions that teachers could come to and just highlight what I thought were kind of the most important things for people to get up to speed with on Google Drive, Docs, and Sheets as well.
Well, you know, it's one of those that Google, when we first went to Google years ago, it certainly wasn't what it was today, but that was always my sleeper service. When I pitched just moving to Google Apps, I pitched it on, hey, we're going to save a ton of money. We don't have to manage it on site. And we were just coming off a huge Exchange issue where our mail server was literally down for 3 days. I mean, being without email for 3 days seems like, you know, unheard of. But when you manage your own Exchange server, it can happen. When I came to work here, it was an older system, still Exchange 03, and this was 2009. This is right at the end of 2009. Mm-hmm. And I already had plans to move to Google. We actually already had the accounts built. And we had, at one point just talked about just go ahead and switching our MX records over. But we decided we got our Exchange server back up and then did the migration 2 months later over President's Day weekend here in the States, which is in February. But I always saw – it was just called Google Docs back then. But I always knew, like, if we could ever get that rolling, I thought that could kind of revolutionize some of our collaboration.
Yeah, I admit to having been very skeptical of Google Docs for a long time. I mean, we've been on Google Apps since 2006, way before they even had a for business or for education version. It was just Google Apps, and it basically was Gmail for your domain. I mean, I think that might even have been the first name for it, Gmail for your domain. And that was literally the first thing I did when I got to Cedars in 06 was say, we weren't moving to it because we actually didn't have anything before then. We just, I don't even know what people did for email back then, but that was the first thing I did was, you know, standard email accounts for everybody, school domain, this is it. And it's been absolutely great for us. I mean, I can count on the fingers of half of one hand how many days we've actually had a problem with it in all those years. And we have literally paid £0 for it in total. So very, very happy as a user of Google Apps for Education, and it's just gotten better and better and better. And I think certainly Google Drive hadn't even been invented when we started using Google Apps. And it came along, and we kind of ignored it for a while. And, you know, having been kind of brought up in the Mac world and the native app world, I was pretty skeptical about HTML and JavaScript-based productivity tools. I kind of regarded it in the sort of, you know, the sort of dog walking on its hind leg sort of thing, that it's not how well it does it, it's that it does it at all. You know, the fact that you could even have a word processor in a web browser was pretty impressive, but it wasn't actually something that you would want to use on a daily basis compared to a native app like Pages or even Microsoft Word for that matter. But it has kind of crept up on us. As I've said in previous shows, it's kind of crept up on us.
And I would even say, too, thinking back to 2006, everybody was still in that you have to have Office to Work model. And yeah. So if it wasn't Word, it was worse. And people weren't thinking multiple devices. They weren't thinking collaboration as much. People were you walked into the office. I mean, I was working in corporate America at the time. You walk into the office, you open up Outlook in one monitor, you had two monitors, and you open up Word in the other, Word and Excel in the other, and that was your job. And yeah. that mindset is really just largely gone. And people thought they needed all the features of Word, and then they realized that they just. I mean, let's be real. Most of the things that people, I would say, do at their office in Word could largely be done in Text Editor.
Yeah. I think there's very much two modes of using something like Word or Excel, which is one is, I mean, the way I use Google Docs as well is very much like an RTF editor. I mean, I use headings, and I use bold and italics and bullet points and occasionally a table, and that's it. You know, I almost never even put an image into a document. It's very, very rare that I would even do something like that. So I use word processors in a very simple way. I'm producing functional documents. I'm not trying to use beautiful documents. And I think if there's somewhere that Google Docs is a little weak, it's probably in the beauty of what it produces. You know, Pages will produce a much nicer looking document in most cases, but Google Docs and Google Sheets have got so many other advantages to them that we find them very useful for the kind of functional documents that we create across the school, both spreadsheets and word processing documents.
Well, and I think, too, the way Google Drive has evolved is it was cloud first. It was collaboration first. So it started with that mindset that you would always be collaborating.
Yeah.
And it does, in some ways, their collaboration feels more seamless, I think, because of that. But another change that's happened is we're not printing as much.
Yes.
And word processing was so you can write something and print it and hold it in your hand. And, I mean, nothing drives me more nuts when I get an email with a Word document attached. It's like this either needs to be a PDF, A, or it needs to be something shared with me if I need to edit it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so our need for that type service or the perceived need for that type of application, I think is gone. Especially when three devices, we will give up some features for the seamless across device compatibility and collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an idea, what we were doing before we went to Google Docs was we were using Basecamp, and everybody was using Pages on their Mac. So what would happen is somebody would write a document, say like a school policy document. They would convert it into a PDF and put it on Basecamp. And that was great until we forgot who put it on Basecamp. And then we needed to change the document, and then we had to go back to whoever it was had made the document, who hopefully they still had it on their Mac, and they could make a change and then upload another version to Basecamp. I mean, that was the kind of workflow that we had, and it was no workflow at all. And then occasionally there was somebody who had done it in Word, and then nobody could edit it properly and blah, blah, blah. And there were some situations we got into where we had the PDF of the document, but nobody could find the original. So we were basically having to either retype it off a PDF or try and use something like PDF Pen to try and convert the PDF back into an editable format and then work with it from there. So very quickly, as the school grew, certainly, and as we added more members of staff, one of the things that just broke down was that model of document collaboration where people would email around a document and then try and have people add to it with comments or edits or whatever, and then bring it back together at the end. It just got very, very difficult. And I think the first thing that that we really did in Google Drive or Google Docs was that we changed the model of writing report cards. So the way that we used to do it was we had a template in Pages, and everybody would write their subject's report card on a single page for an individual pupil, and then they would print each individual page to a PDF, and they would upload that individual PDF to their to that pupil's Basecamp space, and then I would download them all and print them all out into one document. And that was it worked, but it wasn't very good. And then the first thing we did with Google Docs was I said, well, okay, let's change the format a little bit. Here's a Google Doc that we can all edit, which relates to this one pupil. And then each teacher would go in and they would write their part of the report in the space provided for them. And that cut the time that it took for me to assemble these reports down from about 2 days to the time it took me just to print out however many documents we had. And it was a huge win for productivity for me. The only problem then was that some teachers wouldn't be very careful with fonts and styles. So that's something that we're actually going to train pretty hard on, is using the correct fonts and styles so that I don't have to go through and change the font all the time. Because I think what some people were doing was they were writing it in Pages and then copying and pasting it into the Google Doc rather than just writing it straight into Google Doc in the first place. But even with that, it's a huge, huge benefit to my productivity.
Is your official school font Comic Sans or no?
No, it's not. We're very strict on that front. We don't care about anything else, but just no Comic Sans. I just use the standard fonts in Google Docs. That's it.
Chattanooga actually has its own font. They did, someone did a Kickstarter, like a publishing house. They did a Kickstarter, and so there's actually, call it CHA Type. I don't know, like Cha Type. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there's actually a official Chattanooga font.
Very cool.
So, before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Tap Typing. You know, Tap Typing was with us at the beginning of last year to come back again this year to talk to you. They want to talk about their great typing app for the iPad. Now, Tap Typing kind of addresses the thing that I think is the biggest problem with going iPad in the schools. It's learning how to type quickly, especially if you get students who are fast on the desktop, the laptop. This is the app that you need to help train them. It teaches students how to type on the iPad. They've got a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced. They've got a typing test for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard, they support all types of external keyboards and cases. Tap Typing is appropriate for all ages and supports multiple user profiles, which is extremely handy for cart-based classroom environments. After just 3 sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speed by an average of over 60%. So again, that is on average. You can certainly have more than that as well. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and soothes one of the most painful aspects of iPad user experience, that's typing. Now, I'm not just reading this ad. I actually own 81 copies of this this app. We really invested in this app last year. We really like it. It works really well. So everything we're saying, we've done here. It really, really works well. To learn more about Tap Typing, go to gettaptyping.com or just search typing on the App Store. It's the first result. Again, that's gettaptyping.com. We will have a link on the show notes at adaschool.net. But again, especially if you're a new iPad school, Tap Typing will be a very worthy investment for you. So we thank the folks at Tap Typing for sponsoring the show this week.
Yeah, the other thing with Tap Typing that's really good is if you are in a one-to-one school, say, and you've got a lot of kids who are very familiar with iOS and you have new pupils come into the school who are not, it's a great way to get them up to speed as well.
So, yeah, it's I think the app is I'll have to look at the app and I'll put it in the show notes. I believe last time we bought it, I hadn't checked it, but I want to say it was under $5, so I'll have to check it.
I think so. Yep.
It was it's fantastic, fantastic app. It supports volume purchase program as well because it's something that's built for schools. So if you're buying more than 20 copies, you get it half off the retail price.
Yay!
Yeah, well, it was like deals. Our Spanish teacher came and talked to me, and she was asking about some apps. And she's like, I'm really wanting to try some new things. And she's like, I'm going to look for some free apps. And I said, you don't have to do that. Like, we can buy them. Like, mm-hmm. That's really okay. Like, they're really inexpensive. And it's like, kind of blew her mind that, like, yeah, I will tell her, yeah, we can just buy whatever you need. It's not a problem. It's not that much money.
Can I give you a volume purchase pro tip?
Sure.
Keep your eye out for any time an app goes free. And then add, like, 5,000 licenses to your managed distribution system. I have done that for a couple of apps, and it's very handy.
Even if you don't think you'll need it, just go ahead and get it.
Yeah, I think I picked up a couple. The one that we actually use a lot is Notability, and we've certainly bought some licenses for that in the past, but I went ahead and added a whole lot more when Notability went free for a while. So we basically are going to have that for the long term. A couple of others, I did that for Day One as well, and Calendars by Readle. I haven't actually deployed either of those apps, but I've just got them sitting there in case somebody wants them.
It's like, hey, Mr. Spears, can we have Day One? You can have 5,000 copies of Day One.
How many copies would you like? Yes.
You can have, everybody gets a copy of Day One. It's like Oprah, yeah, who out there at in the gym. All right, these are your Christmas gifts for Mr. Spears. You're getting Day One, you're getting new calendars. Yeah. Anyways. We've talked about kind of Google Drive excelling in, as an ecosystem, and it's like, especially if you're a Gmail school and you already use Google Apps, like it's a nice add-on. But where does it fall short as the ecosystem is? What would you say, Fraser?
Well, I think that in terms of where the whole system falls short, I would say that probably the weakest part is that the mobile experience is not as strong as the desktop experience. So I think we're now in a world where many of the best mobile apps are almost feature equivalent to the desktop apps. I'm thinking of things like Evernote and OmniFocus and those real top-tier applications that are as good on the iPad or on the phone or even better than their desktop equivalents. And Google Drive is not in that situation right now. It's gotten much better, and it's getting better again. So I'm confident that it's on an upward track with this kind of stuff. But using them on iOS, there are some very, very severe limitations of both Google Docs and Google Sheets, more in the Docs, I would say. For example, if you have a table in a document, you can't even see it, let alone edit it. You can't create a table, you can't insert an image, all these things. So there's a lot of missing basic functionality on the iOS platform, and I guess it's similar on Android as well. The Sheets app, I think, on iOS is better. It's more for the basic stuff that most people use a spreadsheet for. It's about as usable, but there's a lot of real high-level stuff that you can do in the desktop interface that you can't do on the mobile interface at the moment.
Yeah, I think that if I was Google, or if I was, not Google's not a person, if I worked at Google in their education program and I saw where the growth was, you see it in mobile. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Chromebooks are doing well in education, but you see a lot of iPads and seeing some Android deployments, is you have to be thinking, kind of going back to that thing we talked about with iOS 5, that they went and said, what can we do on the desktop we can't do on mobile? Well, let's go attack that. They almost need to do that on mobile and almost pause everything else and say, we've got to get these up with feature parity. And so we can say, regardless of what device you're using, it's seamless.
Yes, it's certainly not that way right now. And I think the word processor is probably the biggest culprit. But I would agree with you. I think that that's something that needs to be addressed pretty fast. And clearly they are iterating on it quite quickly. But I think it's so far short of where Word and Pages are on the iPad that it's, I don't want to say it's a bit embarrassing, but it's certainly, there are many, many show-stopping missing features that mean you couldn't make even a basic document from start to finish on the iPad. And this is why when I talk about our Google Drive use, the way our pupils use it and the way our teachers use it is vastly different. That our pupils mostly use it as a Dropbox, a free Dropbox version, if you like, whereas our teachers make much more use of the documents and the spreadsheets. But our students do not use that. They're still using Pages, Numbers, and Keynote on the iPad.
Well, and you and I've talked offline about Google Slides and how really weak it is. Certainly on mobile, but even on the desktop, it's just okay. And I've never found myself using it at all. And I wonder if it's because, A, that Keynote is so fantastic, mm-hmm. or if it's, B, that to me, if there was no collaboration within Google Drive, I would probably not use it near as much. Even though I don't collaborate on every document, I know that at any given time that can be collaborated on. I just don't work on presentations collaboratively.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I have done this one time where at the end of last year we were doing a transition meeting for new exams that we're doing next year. And what I asked every teacher to do was to go into this presentation and edit their subject slide and put in the requirements for that subject so that we could kind of go through it in the meeting. And that's the one time I've actually built a presentation collaboratively, and it was very good for that. But what I then did was I wanted to use that presentation as the basis for something I would show to parents at an information evening that we did a couple of weeks ago. And in order to use it at that information evening, I rewrote the whole thing in Keynote because it just was not in a, it was not suitable to show to parents at all. It was ugly and messy, and there was a lot of things you just can't do with it. You know, I think, I believe that you can't even put a chart into Google Slides document. So it's, even on the desktop, it's really, really basic at the moment. It's only just good enough, whereas Keynote and even PowerPoint are more powerful.
Well, and you think about the way presentations work. You know, again, we mentioned that word processing is so you can then print things off. We're not necessarily sending around presentations that via email, or most of us aren't doing this at our webinars all day long, where they're staying digital. You're in some ways going analog with those, where you're actually speaking, you're actually presenting to people that are there. Yeah. And minor visual effects can really matter, and minor or major features can really make or break your presentation. And in your situation, you'd probably been better off just to have them fill out a Google Doc with the information they needed, and then copied and pasted it into Keynote.
Yeah, probably would have been, actually, to be honest. Yeah. Yeah. I was kind of wanting to do it as an experiment, and it did the right thing at the right time, I suppose, but it's not presentation quality, right? It's kind of functional. We all threw together a presentation so we can look at it in a meeting quality. But I would never stand up in front of people and show them a Google Slides document in its current state, because it is below PowerPoint quality, I would say.
You know, I think of presentations as telling a story, where when I do a spreadsheet or when I do a document, I don't consider that to be a story. And certainly if I was writing a report where I cared about that, it wouldn't be in Google Drive or Google Docs. It would be in Pages, where I can kind of have more fine control over every little piece of it, and I'd then make it a nice PDF where I was really concerned about it. But I'm very concerned about the flow and the effects and the transitions and the animation builds and how quickly the text comes in and out. I'm very keenly concerned about that with the presentation. Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess, does Google even use this for, like, Google I.O.?
I'm going to bet you no. Yeah, it doesn't seem to me to be professional grade at all at this time. I'm not saying it can't get better, but I'm saying it's not that good right now. Whereas I think actually Google Sheets, the spreadsheet component, is actually the best part of the whole suite. It's the best, and then the word processing is second best, and then Slides is barely the minimum viable product right now. But we use a lot of Google Sheets, and we're using increasingly more of the advanced features of Google Sheets as well. So in my training schedule, which I'll tell you about in a minute, there's two different sessions. There's basic sheets and advanced sheets, because some of the filtering capabilities and things that you can do there are really pretty powerful. We use a lot of data validation. A lot of us use it for making kind of progression dashboards for our classes. So I have one for my exam class this year, where everybody starts off with columns are the pupils and rows are the outcomes they're supposed to hit, and everybody starts off red. And the aim of the next year and a bit is to turn them all into green boxes, and that way the pupils are on course for their exam.
You know, I think I mentioned it earlier, but I think one of the things that will always help Google Drive, even 5 years from now, assuming that iCloud and Microsoft 365 continue to progress, Google was always cloud first, and they sacrificed features for better ability to work better in the cloud, and they've added things obviously over the years. And you wonder if that will always give them a little bit of a leg up, because you hear people say, you hear a lot of podcasters say they use Google Drive for collaboration for their show notes, and we certainly do now as well. And you always hear kind of these ribs about, we tried iCloud or Pages, sharing didn't work. Yeah. And it's like, is iCloud and Pages collaboration ever going to be as good as Google Drive? Because, I can do without some features if the collaboration is perfect. And nothing's going to be more frustrating about using Pages on iCloud.com if it's not perfect. Well, and it's even another gripe, is you can only use the web edition of Pages. You can't even use the local one.
I mean, there's just a lot of work to do there, yeah.
Just let the Opal app, the the actual downloadable app for Pages, just like when you open a iCloud document, just, I don't know, just let it be like a web view in the back end or something so it can do simultaneous collaboration. But I just, you know, I think it's always kind of felt, you always felt like Google is a little bit ahead on those kind of cloud features. And you wonder if it's just because they're better at it or if it's because they were there first and it was always built for that.
I think it's a bit of both of those things, but it seems fair to say that what Google has done is they've done the hardest part, which is to get that seamless simultaneous collaboration correct and safe to do. I mean, I don't think I've ever had a situation where a Google Doc has been corrupted by two people working on it at the same time. They've got that rock solid. And even as I'm criticizing the mobile experience for Google Docs, they at least still have that part, right? So, I mean, you and I are both looking at this Google Doc right now. I'm looking at it on my iPad, and I'm watching you highlight and change certain bits even as we talk. And that part is available on the mobile platforms, and that's really, really important. And I think even with as the mobile platform moves forward, I think Google are still prioritizing the collaboration over the features. And I think that's probably the right thing to do because that is Google Docs' unique selling point, is that it's a seamless collaboration between people. And that's what got us moving to it, was that we wanted that ability to have one document that everybody sees, that and nobody's got their own copy or whatever. It's one document. Everybody can change it if they need to. They can edit it if they need to. There's control. There's versioning. There's all these great things in it. And it's just changed, you know, the stress levels immensely compared to firing around Word and Pages documents on email that we used to do.
Yeah, I actually had a person email me, they asked me whether to come to their office. They said, I've got a lot of these documents. I don't know which is the master. I don't know which one has the most recent edits. And they had like nine Pages documents where they had kind of passed around as a handbook for something. They had passed around Pages documents and they were trying to like make edits. And I said, this should have been in Google Drive. Like obviously you can save it or copy and paste it to Pages later to do the pretty stuff. But gosh, I mean, you've got nine copies of this and they were all like, I mean, you could sort of look at the timestamps, but then she didn't think the most recent one was the most recent one. And it's, there's no good way to figure that out. Like you're just going to kind of have to look at them and see which is, you know, which is the most recent. And that problem really goes away here with Google Drive.
Yeah. I think one of the things I would like to see in Google Drive is the ability to prevent anybody like copying any text out of a document. Because even still, people are very wedded to having their copy of something. And one of the things I've seen people do is like they'll take their shared document that we're all working on, they'll make their own copy of it and edit that version. And then I don't know if they're scared to let other people see them working or something like that. I don't know what it is, but I really would like to be able to say, well, like, not only can you only look at this and not change it, but you can't even copy the text out of it either or make a copy of it or do anything else with it. You can only look at it on the web. And there's some documents we have that I really want to keep very, very strict control over as well.
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive Networks. They unleash the power of mobility in your school and in your workplace. Aerohive's incredible technology enables organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, and grow their businesses. Deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide, Fraser and I are two of those. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and a distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, and simplified cost-effective networks. One of the things I love about Aerohive is there's no controller. So you don't have a controller in the cloud. You don't have a controller on site. There's really no way to take an Aerohive network down completely, except either, obviously if you lose the internet, you can't get on the internet, but you can still connect an Aerohive AP and do local printing and access local resources. But it's basically like having a little mini firewall in every access point. And so everything's happening at the edge. All your application visibility control, all your security, everything's happening at the edge. And so you can do a public or private cloud. If you do a public cloud, even if their data center blows up, your network is still working fine. Users would never know that anything was wrong. We're big fans of Aerohive. Check them out on the web at aerohive.com. It's AEROHIVE.com. And they have a great community forum called Hive Nation. That's at community.aerohive.com. If you want a link to both of those, you can check them out in the show notes at outofschool.net, episode 101.
Yeah, so, I love my Aero Hive. I just had my first conversation of the year as to how come you're using so much YouTube on my network. I have that every year, and I don't know who it's going to be each year, but I found my person for this year, and I've had that conversation already, thanks to Aero Hive.
Well, you ought to start some sort of poll with the teachers and see, all right, who's going to be the first one to lose their game privileges? Who's going to be the first one to use this?
Who's going to be the first one to get the bandwidth talk from the IT guy? Yeah.
So, we've kind of talked about Google Drive on a high-level perspective, and we talked about some of the advantages and disadvantages. What are some of the key advantages if you're an iPad school? And you mentioned the notes here. Mm-hmm. The amount of storage you get is incredible.
Yeah, well, this was just after we started deploying the Google Drive app to students. The way it used to be was that you got 25 gigs for Gmail and 5 gigs for Google Drive. And just after we started using Google Drive, after we had looked at Dropbox and Evernote and Google Drive as three different possible solutions to the problem of students making big data on their iPads and then filling up the space on what were 16-gig iPads at the time, just after that, Google announced that they were going to unify that quota. So it was 30 gigs shared between your mail and your drive, which was amazing for us. It was like Christmas in July, because what happened was that our students were using a tiny fraction of that 25 gigs of email. Students were not doing big data with email at all, but they were eating up the drive space because they were making videos, they were making, photographs and whatever they want, big documents they wanted to keep. And their quota suddenly went from 5 gigs to 30 gigs, and we paid nothing more for it. And that was really, really fantastic. So that's something that I think this is a really important part of a one-to-one iPad deployment, is some kind of nearline storage for your devices. And I don't really think that Google Drive offers, for this purpose, Google Drive offers much more that functionality-wise than Dropbox, let's say. But it is, the reason we chose it was because it was integrated with our existing login system. All those people already had a Google account through our Google Apps. And it was this quota, it was 30 gigabytes for free, whereas Dropbox was not integrated with our login system, and it was only 2 gigabytes for free. And then it was money per user on top of that. So, and this was even before Google dropped the prices on additional storage for Google Drive. So we have a couple of teachers now who are looking at getting more than the standard 30 gigabytes, because they've started to really opt into Google Drive over Dropbox. And we're going to obviously pay for that because it's not expensive. We can buy them additional storage on the order of, what is it, like $2.99 a month for 100 gigabytes?
Yeah, it's $1.99.
Is it more?
$1.99. And I think, obviously Dropbox did cut their pricing last week, but they mm-hmm. didn't attack the low end like Dropbox has. Because $10 is still $10 a month. And that's not, it's not expensive, but if you one of the things you got to think about is like, if you're thinking, okay, well, I have 10 teachers that need this, well, then you got $1,000 a year and Dropbox payments.
Yeah.
$2 a month, it's nothing. That's cost of a Coke.
Yeah. It's essentially trivial. I said to the first teacher who got close to their quota, I said, look, ask the finance office for this, but please ask them for like 2 years worth at a time, because the payments are so small, we're not going to reimburse you, £1.48 per month. We're going to give you 2 years worth and you handle it yourself.
Well, I wish Google had a way to pay for that yearly, because I'm kind of in that same boat. It's like you're turning in receipts for $2.
Yeah. And we looked into that, and there is a way. If you're a Google Apps for Business user, you can actually centrally purchase and provision storage licenses for users. But if you're a free education account, you don't get that facility. I actually ended up on a support phone call with Google about this. And basically what you've got to do is that the individuals have to buy their own additional storage, and then they have to invoice the school for the reimbursement.
I don't understand that either, because it's likely the same kind of operation. There's a finance office involved, have to get approvals, have to get reimbursed. Yeah. I just don't totally get that. But and it would be cheaper for them, because then they wouldn't have to pay a per transaction fee on the credit card.
Yeah. Yeah. Doing it through purchase orders. Lots of schools don't even have credit cards. And certainly in the public sector in Scotland, I don't think any school is even allowed to have a credit card. They're only allowed to pay for things with purchase orders or invoicing. So having something like that, you mean Apple have got that for volume purchase now. You can purchase order or volume purchase credit and then apply that on the back end. And you can, Google does have that facility, but they just don't make it available to education customers as far as I understand it.
Which is probably one of the people that need it the most.
Yeah.
But, you hit on that, and I think that is one of the key strengths of Google in education and in Google at the Google for Work. I don't know if you got the 9 emails I got the other day. They've renamed Google Enterprise. Yeah, it's like I get that when Google has an email or when Squarespace does, gosh, I get so many emails because I've got like 9 Squarespace accounts. Yep. I've got like 9 Google Apps domains I manage. So you're just loaded up with stuff. But that it's a central login system. I mean, we've mentioned before that Google for a lot of schools is like the Active Directory in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the first thing they set up and so if the students already have that, teachers already have that, and you have two services, you have something like, even if Dropbox was cheaper with the same price, it's hard to justify rolling out another account system.
Well, that was one of the main reasons I didn't want to go to Dropbox, despite having been a very happy Dropbox user for a long time. I didn't want to do it because I didn't want to manage a second set of logins for students. And that was a big, big thing in favor of going to Google Drive, was that we already had deployed these accounts. They were already set up. And more now, the Google apps, the iOS apps that you install on your device, they know about the presence of each other and they have shared keychains so that you're already logged into, if you download the dedicated Sheets application and you've got Drive there already, you log into it, says, oh, you're this person, let's go ahead and just log in. It's great.
Yeah. Couldn't be easier. That would be interesting if you could ever, like, I'm trying to think out loud, or if you could ever, like, somehow share Touch ID data. Let's say you're getting a new device, if you could just, your Touch ID would somehow authenticate Google. But maybe that's kind of out there, because then Google would have to know about your Touch ID information. That's not going to happen.
One day.
Yeah. So what are the, like, if you're not an iOS school and you're a Mac school, what are the advantages? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that for me has become a really big advantage is I no longer have to deal with the questions like, how do I send something that is too big to email? I mean, Google certainly gives a 25 meg attachment limit. That's generous. That's very generous.
Yes.
Of course, the kicker is if the person on the other end doesn't have that. But
which they usually can't, because most school email systems are much, much meaner than that. I've had problems sending like 5 megabyte files to people.
Yeah, if it's like an exchange, it's probably an on-site exchange, it's probably 5 megs. And so one of the things that Gmail does is if you try to embed a drop-in attachment that is larger than 25 megs, you have the option to automatically upload it to Google Drive and insert a link in there. It handles all the security in there. And it's really seamless. And I know you could do that before by first uploading it to Drive, making it public with the link, and then copying the link. But this has just kind of made that easier, where I don't even know if teachers know what they're doing. I get this a lot. Like, if we're doing something for photos and I need to print a bunch of photos for something, they'll send them to me. They come in as Google Drive links, and then I don't know, then they know how to do them. The downside, like in Apple Mail, is I have to go open and download each one individually. Mm-hmm. But what I do in those situations, I just go to the webmail and there's a button that says like save all these to Drive. Yeah. Just do that and then it'll just download automatically to my computer.
Yeah, that integration is really nice. And that's also now working on the iOS version of Gmail. So we have, I just set up our photocopier to act as a network scanner. And one of the cool things you can do there is just email it to yourself. And then I just use the Gmail app on my phone to just push those files right into Drive. Because there is no way to email into your Google Drive just yet without going through a third party, which I'm not totally keen on doing, because you're never that sure about the security and the provenance of some of those things. But being able to just, that integration between mail and Drive is getting to be pretty powerful.
It just takes the complexity out of computing, where, like a teacher just wants to send a large attachment. They don't know how big it is, and they don't want to have to go to get info. Oh, it's 26 megs. What are we going to do? And that's the failure of technology. We have, of course, I know, obviously, mail servers are, you can load them up quick with attachments, but the fact that it just handles that because of the integration with the entire ecosystem, it's really, really nice.
Yeah, my only complaint about that whole integration part is that it's not really very tidy. So it's sort of like, we'll upload this thing, we'll dump it into the root folder of Google Drive, and then we'll just make it a shared document. So then you end up having all these extra shared documents And I think if there was maybe like a kind of, you know, sent attachments folder or something that you could put them all into. At least I don't think there was something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that would be, because I'm kind of, I don't want to mess up my drive, if you know what I mean. I want to keep it tidy as much as I can. And I spent a lot of time at the start of the year doing that over last year. And this is that's another conversation to be had as well. Like, how do you actually organize your school with shared folders in Google Drive? How does that happen? That's a whole other show in itself, I might add.
Sorry, my phone rang again.
No, that's okay.
I gotta figure out how to turn that off. So I guess we can leave this part in. But listeners, you probably it's edited out. But I've got two phone calls we're recording, and because I have Yosemite and iOS 8, it's ringing on my computer, and I don't know how to turn it off on my computer because I have notifications turned off, but it's still ringing. So I don't know what I'm doing here. So if anybody knows, let me know.
Yeah, it's a little bit of chaos there. I just upgraded my phone to iOS 8 10 minutes ago. I was not able to restore its backup so far.
I guess this is important. This is completely getting off the subject. But if you followed me on Twitter on Saturday, I ran into the same thing Fraser's running into today. That for whatever reason, if you try to upgrade your phone to iOS 8 from Yosemite, and this is the developer preview or the public beta, because I'm on the public beta, it just bricks the phone. And I was at a spot where it would not even launch iTunes if the phone was connected and it was in the DFU mode.
Yep.
And so I had to go to another computer that had Mavericks on it to install the beta. And now it can sync fine. It's just kind of mind-boggling that happens. But I had a real tough time getting my phone to restore from backup. And this was an iOS 7 backup. It would get to the place where it was like setting up iCloud, and it would just take forever. I literally had to let the phone sit there for 30 minutes while it was quote unquote setting up iCloud.
Yeah.
And the next time the applications wouldn't download correctly, like it would just hang. And then finally a third time it worked and been happy since.
Yeah. I think I might just leave my phone set up as a new thing because, you know, your iPhone kind of accretes all these apps over time and you only need like 10 of them. I've installed the most essential things, which are Overcast and Tweetbot, and we'll see what else I need after that.
well, that's a good way to do it. It's just like don't install anything, and then as you need it, just download it. My fear with setting that up is like then I've got to download Dropbox, got to download 1Password because I can't do anything without those two in terms of because my Dropbox, my 1Password data is in Dropbox. So yeah. Once I get those, then I can go to town. Now, one of the things that's neat, and I don't know how it did it, but I re-downloaded Overcast the other day. I was testing something, and it somehow like re-linked me without having to log back in, and I'm wondering if it's doing it through Twitter.
Could be. I'm just looking at mine right now. I just opened up Overcast for the first time. It's asking me to log back into my Overcast account, which I will do.
Have you set Twitter back up in your Apple or the iPhone Twitter part?
Not so far, no.
So I wonder if that must be the way it's doing it then, because it's not because if it was going by something in the phone, obviously yours would have not required you to log back in, but mine didn't. But one of the things that kind of drives me nuts is the messages recently contacted list can get really, really junked up when you have your phone on the same OS for a couple of years. So it's a nice way to clean that up.
Yeah. Let me tell you what I installed just straight away. Evernote, Instagram, Overcast, Tweetbot, iTunes U, and Netflix. That's all I got so far. I may have to put my weather app back on, and I'll put Google Drive on, but beyond that, who knows?
Did you drop OmniFocus on? Did you mention that?
I don't have that yet, but I'm going to put that on. Yeah, that's a definite as well.
Can't wait for the iPad version. Have you seen the screenshots?
I have. Yeah. The thing I'm really looking forward to with the iPad version is having it do background syncing.
Yes.
Which I've gotten so used to on the iPhone that it's weird to see the app badge on the iPad getting out of sync with the one on my phone just because I haven't opened it in a couple of days.
Yeah, because I'm one to mark tasks off on my phone, like especially if I have to go to a classroom to help a teacher with something. Mm-hmm. It'll be a task on my phone, just mark it off. And then you get back to your iPad and, you know, 8 hours later or whatever, and you're like, oh, wait, I have all these undone tasks. It's sending me all these alerts. Hey, these things were due 5 minutes ago. It's like, no, I'm done with those. Just sync in the background.
Yeah.
OmniGroup's good. They're good people.
Yeah, and they like to get it right, so I'm happy to wait for them.
Well, and their syncing just works. I've never had an issue with the syncing.
No, just, they, just works. They take some pretty good care over that.
But, yeah, so that's I got a phone call. That's what brought that conversation. So it's a neat feature, but I don't know how to turn it off.
Yeah, stop trying to make phone calls happen.
Exactly. Well, one of them was my kid pediatrician. Then I have a do you have a drive home buddy? Like, you don't have a long drive, but I have a buddy that we call 3 out of 5 days a week and talk on the way home. We just drive home at the same time. So,
yeah, no, I don't drive that long, yeah. Fortunately, because if electric car doesn't last good.
But yeah. See, you know, to kind of wrap up the show, mm-hmm. There are multiple ways you can access Google Drive. We've mentioned the web. We've mentioned the mobile apps, but you've also got an app for the Mac and for the PC. And, mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that is nice about it is it works very similar to Dropbox. You drop a folder in there, it syncs to the web. It really, you know, kind of couldn't be, you know, simpler. I keep my entire photo library in Google Drive. I mm-hmm. have, you know, 78 gig photo library sitting in my Google Drive account. If you have a Google Doc, it actually doesn't download it as a Word doc. It downloads it in what's called a .gdoc, and that's basically just a shortcut to the document on the web. But the cool thing about that is that you can then use a tool like Alpha or LaunchBar to find the file quickly and open it.
Yeah, my biggest gripe about the Google Drive app for Mac is that it doesn't support two accounts. So I've got my personal Google Drive account, which I use like my Dropbox, and I've got my school one as well, which has got a lot of stuff in it, and I can choose one or the other to sync to my Mac, but I can't have both. And at the moment, I've chosen my personal one because it's got so much photo stuff in it. And I like to have that on my Mac as well, so Backblaze will get it. So I wish they would support more than one account.
Well, because Dropbox doesn't have, like, they have multiple account support, but it's like if you have a business and a personal account. And that's, yeah. You know, I'd really be fine with that if that's what Google offered as well. Mm-hmm. Because I can see why they don't want to let you link to personal accounts, because then you can start to like chain together storage quite a bit. Another thing I would like to see Google offer is better selective sync, where right now you can only, it's basically only the root folders. With Dropbox, you can, like, let's say you've got a personal folder, like, you know, my Dropbox, I've got like basically two folders outside of all the shared ones. It's personal and work. And inside those are like various things. Well, some of that stuff I want to hide, some of that stuff I don't. But with Google Drive, like, it's either kind of all or none. Like, you can either hide the entire personal folder or you can download it all.
Yeah. Yep. I wonder if I could share a folder between my personal account and my school account.
You can. And if you did that enough, like, let's say you had one master account, mm-hmm. then you kind of had, I mean, you could just go to like create 9 Gmail accounts. You could link together like shared folders mm-hmm. and you could totally have a ton of free space.
Yeah, I suppose that could work because, you know, I can create something like 250 different domain accounts, each of which has got 30 gigabytes. There we go.
Well, and what's cool is because they don't double tax you like Dropbox does, where Dropbox, the whatever's in the shared folder counts against both, which I think is not right because they're not having to store it twice. But with Google, it only counts against like the share. So I have our photo library shared to my wife's Google account. Mm-hmm. She just has like the free account. Well, doesn't affect her. You know, mm-hmm. So it still says she's using like, you know, 1% of her storage from just whatever she has in there. So it's really nice that Google does it that way, because again, that's what seems fair, because they're not storing it twice.
Yeah, no, it is. I think Dropbox have taken a tip from the American phone carriers. You know, is it not true that you guys get charged for sending an SMS and receiving it?
Oh, totally. Yeah,
well, see, I think in the UK we only get charged to send it, and it's free to receive.
Yeah, and now, you get charged for both. It's just, it's crazy to see like the fall of SMS. With iMessage, it's just like that. Of course, I still have unlimited. We still pay unlimited. I think I pay my wife's account. I'm on the school account. My wife's account. I think I pay $10 or $20 a month for unlimited. But they charge you so much for like a la carte. I think it's like a quarter a message. Yeah. Then it would cost me more for her not to have unlimited for her few friends that don't have iPhones.
Yeah, that's it's commodity stuff now, that, isn't it?
Need better friends.
What was it, Craig Federighi called them? Your green bubble friends?
Yeah. It's like, so listen, we're going to have talk. Either you're going to need to get an iPhone or we're done. Now, I tell you what will drive me nuts is when you have friends that you know have an iPhone and they have iMessage turned off.
Oh, my sister does that, and she does it because apparently iMessage can't meet her strict requirements for delivery time. She's only using WhatsApp.
Well, I think a lot of people I know, like, they somehow, their kids started getting their text messages, and they didn't investigate, like, how to fix that. Like, just turn off iMessage on their iPad.
Because they were sharing Apple ID.
Yeah, and so, like, all their text messages showed up on their kid's iPad. But it's like, just get green bubbles killing me.
Yeah, yeah. So, let me talk you through the sort of syllabus, if you like, if that's not too grand a term, for what I put together for teaching our teachers about Google Drive. And many of them have already been using it in order to, you know, complete report cards or look at, you know, contact information and stuff like that that we keep in a spreadsheet. But there's, I feel like we're at this situation right now where many of them are using it in a very basic and disorganized way because we haven't really trained them on, you know, sort of the best practices with Google Drive. So there's four sessions that I've designed for them. The first one just is called Accessing and Using Google Drive from Your Laptop or Mobile Device. And that's basically an introductory session aimed at getting everybody up and running on all their platforms with Google Drive. So accessing it from the web, uploading and downloading files. So if people want to migrate more of their stuff to Google Drive, that will show them how to do that there. And that will also include, say you've got a Word document that you want to turn into Google Doc, the procedure for uploading it and then converting the Word document into Google document and so on. Organizing and sharing folders in Google Drive. This is a tricky one. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say about this yet, but so far I have created a number of kind of key folders that I've shared with everybody and all the teachers in the school that we want to use for things like, you know, school procedures, school policies, pupil work and things like that. So I think we're going to try and keep it as high level as we can, only have a couple of shared folders and most, you know, so that people's, you know, shared with me sidebar isn't just completely overwhelmed by files here and files there and files all over the place, but just to have a few that are very well-defined places that everybody has access to, everybody can put stuff in. We'll also talk about security in there, so when to share and whom to share with, and what the different levels of access are, you know, viewing, editing, collaborating, and so on. And then looking at the mobile apps and trying to explain the difference between Drive and Docs and Sheets and how they all work together, which might be a little bit challenging because I think Google, when they split out the Docs and Sheets and Slides applications from the Drive application, I think it got more confusing rather than less, unfortunately. And then finally, we'll talk about the Desktop Sync application as well for those people using desktop computers still. So that's session one. Quite a lot to get over. But I think some of those topics we'll deal with in a kind of light-handed manner and then go back into them in later sessions. Does that sound like a good kickoff?
Well, you know, I look at this list and I think, like, that's all stuff that, like, is really, really simple to you and I. But if you're not, like, a Google Drive master, like, that's, you know, these are just, like, core functionality. If you can't get these down, nothing else is going to make sense. It's kind of like people that struggle with, like, the Finder on the Mac.
Yeah.
If you can't get that down, you know, we got to get that.
Everything on the desktop.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I literally had what was I doing? Had the question the other day is they were wanting to upload a document and they uploaded it as an Excel spreadsheet and they uploaded it, but they didn't have it checked where it converted the file. Mm-hmm. And so they were totally perplexed about that. And so I had them turn that on. That's like, well, you need to go re-upload the document. And that she was going into Excel and was trying to do file upload to Google. And it's like, no. Like, you actually got to find the file and then drop it.
Nobody understands the Finder. This is
no, they don't.
This is my fundamental contention with the Mac, is that for all the advanced that the Finder was in the 1980s, nobody understands it, and almost nobody masters the use of the file system. And this is why I'm so nervous about iCloud Drive, is I'm just scared that Apple's going to bring all that confusion into iOS pretty soon. But that's a topic for next week or the week after, I think.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you on that, because you and I understand the Finder, but like the vast majority of people, like their files are just on the desktop. Or I had people that just create a folder on the desktop called Documents, and everything's in there, and it's a mess. But you know, you gotta get that foundation. That's the key.
Yeah. So that's the foundation, and then the next session is using Google Docs for word processing. So we're focusing on the Google Docs app and file type specifically. And it's basically just about creating and editing Google Docs. And one of the things I'm going to focus on with that is using defined styles in the document so that when we do collaborate on these documents that I don't have to go through and fix everybody's style and font information. And I think one of the things that, again, another thing that almost nobody understands is pasting without the style, because quite often, like I said, I'll get some sections written in the default font for Microsoft Word and some sections written in the default font for Pages, and I've got to go ahead and unify all of that. So there's things like that, and using creating tables, it's very similar to Microsoft Word, but inserting images is a little bit different because obviously it's web-based, so you have this kind of insert image dialog box that you can use in Docs, and it works well enough. It's just a different procedure than just drag and drop an image right in.
Now, when your folks that are using desktops, you're kind of saying use Chrome for this, right? Like Chrome is your Google browser, correct?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, that's how I worked all last year, was because I had two accounts. I got my personal Gmail account and I've got my work account as well. The way I was doing it was I was using Safari for my personal stuff and Chrome for my Google stuff. But the reason that I have stopped doing that since is because Chrome has become such a battery hog on iOS, or on Mac OS X, sorry, that I can't get to lunchtime using Chrome on battery. I mean, it's just impossible. So until Chrome becomes a more reliable or a better battery citizen on OS X, then I think I'm going to just recommend that people stick with Safari.
What drives me nuts about Safari with Google Drives is, like, it'll have to reload the tab sometimes. Yeah, that's the main issue. But
I don't know. I never see this problem in Safari. I never, ever, ever see it. And I don't know if it's just that I don't keep a lot of tabs open. I really don't. I close all my tabs very regularly. I don't know if it's something that you see when you have, like, 50 or 60 tabs open. Is that maybe that's when Safari has to reload tabs? But I've never seen Safari do that on my Mac. On the iPad, yes, absolutely, but not on the Mac.
Yeah, you're one of the lucky ones.
What can I say? I have good experiences with that stuff. I was just going to just wrap up that word processing section. So there's the whole editing styles and things like that, and then sharing and collaborating on the docs files themselves, like actually working together in a document, is going to be something that we're going to talk about. Using comments in the document, and the fact that comments have their own threaded discussion in the comment is really cool in Google Docs. And then obviously printing and sharing. And I think printing is actually quite confusing for most people in Google Docs, because essentially what it does is it renders a PDF and downloads that to your Mac. And now you've got this version in your downloads folder and you've got this version in your browser. And I've seen some people get pretty confused between the two of those things. And I kind of wish it didn't do that. But I can understand why it does as well.
We've been having, there must have been a bug in one of the recent Chrome builds, because most of our teachers on their Macs use Chrome for Google stuff. And for whatever reason, it's been defaulting the paper size to A3, which, you know, minor detail that it's going to not look right. And so the things are just printing weird. And at the same one of them, it's always been set to A3. And it's like, because, you know, Google on Chrome, they don't use the native like system printer dialog box. Like, they have their own thing. It's simplified in some ways, and you can get to the system one. Yeah. So I'm not, you know, I understand what they're doing, but it's like, you know, that's a detail that matters.
Yeah. Printing from Google Docs is kind of a mess. I think it could be better. And I think probably what they want us to do is they want us to set up Google Cloud Print and print it that way, which I've done from time to time when we were experimenting with Chromebooks. We had Google Cloud Print set up. But again, I had problems with getting the right paper size and the correct printer defaults and things like that. It seems like a very immature system right now, Google Cloud Print. So we'll keep our eye on that, but I don't think it's quite ready for prime time just yet. So the last couple of sessions are going to just be are all about Google Sheets. And I think this is kind of important because spreadsheets have become like everybody's relational database that doesn't really work properly. but it is at least understandable to people, unlike a relational database, which nobody understands. And everybody uses a spreadsheet when they should use a database, and we do it as well. And the reason is that it's easier to work around the problems of using a spreadsheet like a database than it is to teach people about relational databases. Simple as that. So we're going to look at the basics of making spreadsheets and formulas, freezing rows and columns in your view so that you can scroll around and keep your headers. Filling in cells with color is actually really important, because one of the things we use mostly with our Google Sheets is as kind of assessment progress dashboards. So I've got a couple of examples I'm going to use for the courses that I teach where, you know, we, like I said, we have, you know, use conditional formatting and we fill in certain values. So, you know, attempted, passed, needs remediation or whatever, and get different colors in your dashboard for different cell values. And just the basic kind of, you know, text and alignment, sizing columns, sorting the sheet, all that kind of stuff, and then collaborating as well. So that's the kind of basics of spreadsheets, I think. And then there's an advanced version of that as well, which is more to do with filter views and named and protected ranges, which is really important because we have some spreadsheets where we have, you know, the list of pupils involved is protected and only the owner can edit that. But there's some values that other teachers might fill in, like about either behavior or achievement or attendance or different things. But we don't want them editing like the order of the individual pupils. We just want them to put in certain data about those pupils. And then, of course, data validation is pretty important for certain values. And conditional formatting is really cool for when you want to make a dashboard that does change color based on the data that's in the dashboard. Conditional formatting can be really powerful for that. So that's my kind of my four-step teacher guide to getting up to speed with Google Drive. I hope everybody will come. I trust they will.
And there's been some recent enhancements to Google Forms here recently where you can kind of customize the themes more. Of course, you know, here is Google Slides that we kind of mentioned earlier, but, you know, we have our opinions.
Yeah, I'm going to just kid on that Google Slides doesn't exist and see if anybody notices.
If you can figure it out, that's awesome, but I'm not, you know, it's like if somebody says, hey, Mr. Spears, what about this? Use Keynote.
Yeah, Keynote's the way to go. Certainly if you're going to show it to people at the moment. I mean, I look forward to it getting better. It could be very useful, but it's not. It's just not quite there yet, I don't think, as a serious presentation tool.
Well, I think because I look at like presentations as different, the building of it is differently, where I don't immediately start with the presentation. I start with like the storyboarding and the idea. You could certainly do that in Google, you know, Google Docs, where you could say slide one, this is our goal for slide one. This is our goal for slide two. And what's the story we're wanting to tell? When you can do that collaboratively, mm-hmm. then you kind of at some point you're going to need to just go at it with Keynote. Of course, you know Keynote has collaboration in. It's not as seamless, but it certainly does have collaboration in.
Yeah, no, most definitely. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's kind of a run through of the world according to Google Drive at the moment. I think it's been a huge win for us. I think what I aim to do now is I aim to get people up to a more proficient standard. I mean, people are using it at a basic level right now, and I think being aware of the fact that you're collaborating with other people is quite important, even though you're not necessarily collaborating synchronously with other people, because you know when you change the document, you've got to be aware of the impact of that change on other users. And I think those are some of the kind of things that people aren't quite thinking about just yet. Is, you know, this is a shared thing. I'm not just going to do my own thing in the document. It's something that we've got to decide on or agree on. But there's lots of cool things like you know, they have this mode in the word processor where edits become changes, so you can edit the document, all they become suggestions, so you can edit as much as you like, and then it just appears, instead of being an accepted edit in the document, it becomes a suggestion in a comment, which is pretty nifty as well. So everybody can have their own go at it, and then the author can come back and accept or reject all of those changes all across the document.
These are great problems to have. Just happy these tools exist.
Yeah, no, I'm very happy, and it's my default word processor and spreadsheet now is Google Docs. Still, as we've said, Keynote for the presentations, but I think because I'm not, like you said, Bradley, like a word processing document now isn't a paper document, it's an electronic document, and it needs to behave more like an electronic thing. Whereas in times past, it was maybe more about getting a beautiful thing on paper, but now the vast majority of these documents never get printed, and only a few do, and which is why even if printing is a bit wrinkly on Google Drive, it's something we can live with because we should be doing it much more rarely than we have in the past.
Well, we can hopefully soon we can edit these things on our watch.
Yeah, on my huge iPhone as well. I see so many cells in my spreadsheet on my phone. It's going to be
we
great.
We can see two.
Yeah. That's going to be great. Okay, we leave it there for this week?
Yes, I got some, you know, if you're listening to this on Monday, happy iPhone Announcement Tuesday.
Yes, look forward to it. Live keynote streaming on the web. Apple just threw that page up today. So I'm going to be sitting back. And this is the one day of the year, or one of the 2 days in the year, where I don't have to put the kids to bed. It's a little something we put in the prenuptial agreement.
Yeah, it's like Chris also will be at work, and totally we'll be watching that at work. It counts.
Oh, that's work. No question about it. All right, Bradley. All right, let's wrap up. Where can people find us on the web? I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, we'll see you all after the iPhone 6.